Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Shirley Enebrad, and she's the author of Over the Rainbow Bridge, which is about her son's journey from here to heaven. It's about his cancer journey, in fact, which he suffered from the age of 3 up to his death at the age of 9. It's a wonderful book to read. I've read it completely. It has many humorous stories, also many heart-touching moments. And I must say, at the end of it, one has to admire the courage of Corey, who is her son. He has such great faith in himself. Anyway, we shall hear more about this. Welcome to the program, Shirley.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
Well, it's such a wonderful story. You obviously had to get this out to people, and that is what you evidently found in the course of time. I don't think you imagined in the first place you would ever be writing a book.
No, well, before he died, he made me promise that I would write a book to help teach people not to be afraid of death.
Yes.
So this was fulfilling his promise, the promise I made to him.
Yes, yes. Well, I think you've clearly been a most wonderful mother through that whole period. One wonders how you actually cope with it at times, but it must have been extremely stressful for you, because you knew in advance, because of what Corey told you, that he wouldn't live very long. So maybe we could start there. What did you think when he first made comments like that about the future?
Well, he was 3, and he told me that he wasn't going to get to grow up. So I kind of already knew, because I'd had a premonition when I was 10 years old that I was going to have an ill child that would die, and that together we would teach people not to be afraid of death. So when he was born, he was very advanced in so many of his abilities. So I knew fairly early on that it was him. Of the children that I would be having, that he was the one that was going to fulfill that premonition. And so when he told me that, I wasn't surprised, but it was, you know, it was pretty hard.
Absolutely. You didn't want to hear it, but on the other hand, you had this premonition and also his word that he was the one. I mean, he had some remarkable abilities at a very early age. I gather that he swam at 4 months old, and it, quite unbelievably, you tell us that he swam a width on one breath.
He did. He did. He was a little guppy, and he would fight the teacher. He wouldn't want to come up for air. He had such strong lung capacity, though. He swam the width of an Olympic-sized pool in one breath.
Gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite incredible, isn't it? You obviously had a child that was somewhat different to most others.
Oh, absolutely. He was different from the very beginning.
Yeah. And on top of that, after this swimming feat, I gathered that he actually started to walk and also talk at 5 months old, so he advanced very quickly.
Yeah, well, he was actually scooting on the floor at 3 months old, which is unheard of. And he was just early with everything and so articulate from such a young age that it was pretty astounding. People used to just be in awe of him at the grocery store because of the things that came out of his mouth. Sometimes so funny.
I mean, clearly you must have been very proud of him at that time to think you had this really remarkable child. Now, I mean, when I said there were moments of humour in the book, I can't remember now the exact details, but I recall you mentioned that at 9 months old, you found him one day on the top of the fridge.
He'd pulled all the drawers out, and then he got to the counter, and then he opened the cabinet, and he used the shelves like a ladder, and then hoisted himself onto the top of the fridge so he could get to the cookie jar. So yes, he was a very mischievous child.
I think if he'd have grown up, he would have been in his own business, I think, and been very successful by the sound.
I believe you're right.
Yeah. Now, we can even go up to 1 year when you said that he spoke with adults, and presumably you mean that he could speak quite intelligently. Give us some examples of how clever he was at that age.
Well, he and my brother actually challenged him to a puzzle-making contest. And, you know, I think they were maybe 100-piece puzzles or 200-piece puzzles, and he put the puzzle together in half the time that it took my brother, my older brother, by the way. So my brother was probably 30, and my son whipped him. But he could sit and have a conversation with people by the time he was a year old.
I mean, could he reason in conversation? I mean, did he have the powers of doing that, or was it more straightforward?
No, he was unbelievable. When he was not much older than a year, maybe, you know, not even a year and a half, he could, I have five brothers and two sisters. He knew who all of his cousins were and who they, you know, which aunt and uncle they went to. And my dad's family, there was 14 children, and he knew the ones that lived closest to us and who their kids were and grandkids. And I mean, he was just amazing that he could keep track of all that at such a young age.
Yes. So he had an exceptional memory apart from anything else.
Mm-hmm. And he was a real people person.
Yeah. I guess by now, when you look back at what happened, you realize that all this was intended to be. But did you ever dream that you would get so involved in it? And the outcome of all this is that you work in, I believe, television, and goodness knows what else, to promote the story. And as you said at the opening, you want to help people live and not fear death.
Right. Well, you know, when I had that premonition when I was 10, that sort of was the beginning of my understanding of what path I was supposed to take. But because of my son, my degree is in art, and I'm a TV producer now because of him and the people that we met while he was still alive. So that was pretty remarkable right there. And then, he told me before he died, you know, that he chose me to be his mom because I was supposed to help Elizabeth Kubler-Ross teach people not to fear death, because if you fear death, then you can't live your life fully. So he had a real affinity for the song The Rose that was done by Janis Joplin way back because of that one line about fearing death. So his whole purpose, you know, was wrapped up into teaching people and inspiring people to live. So the book is really more about how to live your life the best way you can, no matter how much time you're given. I mean, it's not really about the death and dying part. That's part of the story, but it's more upbeat and more straightforward about how to live your life and the examples that he taught people.
Right. I mean, talking of TV, I understand that you wrote that, well, it must have been a short documentary, I guess, The Courage of Corey, and that actually won a special Emmy Award. Tell us a little bit about that, how you came to make it. How long ago was it?
Well, actually, that was done by a friend of mine who ended up being my mentor in the television business. And it was done right before he passed away. So he actually got to see it because it was finished before he died. And she's the one that, after meeting me through her story about Corey, recruited me to be in television. So it did. It won a special award. And I later won an Emmy for a show that I did about children and cancer that aired on his birthday some years later.
So is that something that ended up on a DVD or a CD? I mean, do you sell sort of copies of that?
You know, it was on television. It was on the ABC station here, but I don't think it's aired for a long time. Pieces of it aired on the Oprah show a few years ago. They did a little story about us on Oprah. And unfortunately, my book wasn't ready yet. I probably could have sold a lot more books if I'd been on Oprah then, after the book was written. But it did help a lot of people. Even now, I get emails and letters from people that have read the book, and they talk about how Corey's stories help them cope with either the death of a loved one or an illness in themselves, or just gives them a new appreciation about how to live their lives.
And I think also importantly, what has come out of it is you're also teaching people how to handle the problem, as in your case, mother to child. You're helping them to realize that death is not the end. And maybe that helps your whole purpose in helping somebody through their illness.
Oh, absolutely, because I am the president of a nonprofit that helps children with cancer and their families. It's called Candlelighters. I think there's one in England, but it's Candlelighters Childhood Cancer Foundation, and I help support families with kids with cancer, and then I'm also a grief specialist. I do workshops and weekend retreats and one-on-one grief counseling, in addition to doing television, and I'm writing another book.
Oh, are you? Right. Oh, you've been a busy person.
I'm very busy.
to say the least. Now, just coming back to some of the funny, humorous moments in your book, I love the idea of you finding Corey reading the Playboy. I don't know how old he was at that age. You read it.
You know, he was just a toddler, and he became obsessed with boobies. But he actually did start reading really young, and when he was two, I had to stop getting the newspaper because it upset him. He could read the headlines and stuff.
Yeah. That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
But of course you knew later that his whole reason for being upset was because he obviously was a very highly spiritually developed soul, wasn't he?
He was amazing because, you know, we didn't go to church. I hate my grandfather's rolling over in his grave, but we didn't go to church. And when he got sick, we definitely didn't go around big crowds of people because of the potential for germ exposure. So when he started telling me all these spiritual things, I was stunned, especially when he talked about reincarnation when he was a toddler. And then later, you know, when he started having his out-of-body experiences, the things that he described in heaven were just shocking to me, because I had read things in magazines or whatever about it. But, you know, he certainly had not. And he came back with messages from the other side of the Rainbow Bridge. That's basically how the title of the book came to be, because that's how he crossed over to the other side for a year and a half before he died, and came back with messages from people that he didn't even know. And half the people that he brought messages for, he didn't know the recipients of the messages either. So there was no way that he would know these people or know their stories. And he was just a little kid when that happened. So it was pretty confirming for me, but pretty strange for people that don't believe in that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Well, I think we respect everybody's opinion. But for you, the proof was really in what Corey told you and the way it worked out. I'm also amused by the fact he was only 15 months old when he said to you, "Do you remember when I was bigger?"
Yeah, that was mind-blowing for me because, you know, I believed that, you know, he was going to be the one that got sick just because he was doing everything so early, and I always say he was in fast forward. But when he started talking about, you know, "Remember when I was bigger," and I'm going, "What?" You know, I mean, he's barely taller than my knee.
Yeah.
I'm looking down at this little toddler going, "Really?" So, you know, "No, I don't, but can you tell me about it?" And the stuff that he told me was pretty amazing. You know, maybe even sort of... Pardon me?
Tell us something about that.
Well,
something
that
told you about when he was bigger.
The first thing that he told me was that that we were brother and sister, that I was his older sister, and that his name was Tony and my name was Marcia. And I said, "Really?" And I said, "Where did we live?" You know, and I wanted him to describe a house or something. And he said in a place with lots of trees and grass called Kentucky. Well, this is a baby. You know, he didn't know anything about Kentucky. I mean, at that point, he didn't even know we lived in Seattle, Washington. So I was so blown away. And then he started telling me about his new horse. He said, don't you remember my horse that I got? And the horse's name was Star. So I ran out of the room to grab a piece of paper and a pencil so I could write these notes down. And by the time I got back, which was less than 30 seconds later, he had gone on to start playing with something else and didn't want to talk about it anymore. But he used to drop little pearls of wisdom like that on me all the time. He was a very interesting child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, did he ever speak about that again at any other time?
He spoke about other lifetimes. He went off to a camp, Good Times, for kids with cancer.
Yeah.
And when I picked him up, I took him out to dinner, and he started telling, he was so excited. He was telling me about these other boys. I think there was three of them that he met at camp. And he said that they all instantly recognized each other. And they were fast friends. And he started talking about previous lifetimes with them. And the person that was with me was not somebody that had ever encountered a child like this before. And he was kind of sitting at the dinner table with his mouth wide open going, what is he talking about? So, yeah, it was pretty stunning for my date. But his whole purpose was to, I think, to confirm for me what my belief system had always been like, and to teach other people that there is an afterlife, and that there, you know, that death isn't the end.
Yes. Now, we'll move on a little bit in his age here. What was it at 3 years old that had something to do with the bike?
Oh, he got on a bicycle, his friend's bicycle, and rode down the hill. He'd never been on a bicycle before that.
Oh,
and my parents lived down at the end of the street from where I lived. And right, they lived on the corner. And we lived on a fairly busy street, but the street that it intersected with at my parents' house was really an arterial, and I was scared to death. So I'm running down the street trying to get him to stop. Well, he didn't know how to stop because he'd never ridden a bike before. So he's yelling, how do I stop this thing? So he turned into my parents' yard and then sort of just laid it down on the grass in the middle of their yard. Luckily, they had a big yard, but he would do things like that.
Yeah. And he didn't know where the brakes were, but he still wanted to ride.
He got up there and just took off.
Yes,
that's the kind of kid he was.
Now, you had a spell at home with Corey where it appeared you did, or you may have had a ghost in the house. There were strange footsteps, etc. Clothes disappeared, and I think other things appeared that shouldn't have been there. Tell us a little bit about that period and how you actually cleared it up in the end.
Well, that was an interesting thing because the idea that there was a ghost there occurred before Corey was born. But I think it was as soon as I moved into the house, I could sense that I wasn't alone. And my husband was working at night then. And we had just moved in, and I was putting paper on the shelves in the kitchen cabinets. And I was talking to my mother, and I said, Mom, you know, I don't really feel like I'm here by myself. And she said, well, does it feel heavy, or, you know, does it feel bad? And I said, no, I just don't think I'm here by myself. Well, then I started hearing footsteps on the stairs in the middle of the night when I'd be up either reading or embroidering or something. So I kind of knew, because I'd get up to look, I'd be the only one there. Well, then after Corey was born, things started disappearing. And you know those things that are plastic baseball bats, and then they have balls that have holes in them? Wiffle
yes.
bats? I think I bought him at least 15 or 18 sets of those, and they always disappeared immediately, never to be found again. Then when my daughter was born, some of her things started missing, and then things started appearing in the closet in the front hallway. At that point, I was single and had a friend who needed a place to stay. She was living with us. So we both thought it was each other's child's raincoat or whatever that was in the closet. And it turns out that it was neither of ours. So when he finally started appearing to the little kids, it turned out that he was a little one. And my daughter, Bri, and her little friend, Justin, were 3 years old. And this little ghost kept appearing to them. So we decided it was time to figure out a way to get rid of him. And my friend Mary was so weirded out by the whole thing that she actually moved back to Salt Lake City, which is where she was from. So I actually found out that I needed to find a Filipino priest and have him come and bless the house. And so he was actually at the second parish that I visited, because we weren't Catholic. So I knocked on the door of this this parsonage, and this Filipino guy answered the door. And he was, I don't know what they call it, like a junior priest. And I told him what my situation was, and he took my address, and he said, you know, go get two wooden crucifixes and bring them back, and I'll get them blessed by the bishop. And then he came to our house, and he walked around it, the outside, three times and said prayers and threw the holy water around. And then he went inside and cleansed the kids' bedrooms. And then he went away, and as he was leaving, he said that he would say three high masses for the repose of the lost little soul, and that he would be gone in 3 days. Well, sure enough, you could feel the difference in 3 days. And my son was really unhappy with me. So I think that he had a little playmate, and he didn't want to tell me about it. But that never happened again. Now, the house that I live in now, a couple months ago, I was having a party, and a plate flew across the dining room. And my husband thinks I'm crazy, but so luckily there was 12 witnesses there. And I found out from someone later that it was one of my my grandmother ancestors on my dad's side trying to give me a message. So that was pretty funny.
Rather a dangerous way to get your attention.
Yeah, well, it didn't even break, even though it flew about 12 feet. But it did almost hit a little girl. This little girl to this day tells people, you know, Shirley has a ghost in her house, and it didn't like me because it threw a plate at me. So she hasn't been over since.
Yeah. Now, what's a little story? I made a note of this. Now, obviously, I can't remember all the details, having read your book in a relatively short time. But what happened with the doctor when Corey was 4 years old, and he told Corey, I believe, to stand on one foot?
Oh, he was being tested before he had to have brain irradiation. And the doctor told him to stand on one foot. So my son, who was a practical joker, walked over and stood on the doctor's foot. And the doctor just started laughing uproariously, and he said, you know how bright this child is, right? And I said, yeah, I know. And he said, he needs to be in a special school for gifted children. And I said, you know, I don't even have the energy to get through what I'm dealing with. I cannot possibly think about school, you know, at this point. Because he was, you know, he was diagnosed right before he turned 4. So anyway, this particular doctor had a friend who ran the gifted school at the University of Washington, and they invited him to come and be a part of the school. So they waived the waiting list and gave him a scholarship and invited him to come and be with kids that were as bright as he was. So he was a little smart aleck, and they were doing a psychological testing on him. And the psychologist said, you know, what color rhymes with head? And showed him a picture of a head. And he didn't want to be tested anymore, so he started getting smart, and he said, stink, pink, what do you think? And she showed him some drawings that were sort of unusual, like people's arms missing, or, you know, somebody mowing a lawn with no arms. And he said, you know what, lady? You shouldn't be showing little kids pictures like that. You could give kids nightmares. That's disgusting. And he walked out of the test. So we found out later that was right when he relapsed. Because he just wasn't feeling well. He was sort of had a cold, and he was not appreciative of the questions she was asking him. So that was the end of that.
So when he made that comment, he was really serious about it. He wasn't being sort of a bit facetious.
No, he was angry.
Yeah.
That was the one on the stink pink, what do you think? But he, they had decided, I think, at that point that his IQ was at 156. That was after the brain radiation. So it was too bad that they hadn't, you know, given him an IQ test before, because they were sort of curious about how many brain cells were killed by the radiation. But he was still very bright, and taught a lot of grown-ups that, you know, you shouldn't talk to kids like that.
I think we should mention here that what Corey actually had was leukemia.
Right. The most common form of leukemia.
Now, I don't know if this was a side effect of or what was happening to you over these years, but I get the impression you suddenly started to write poetry.
Well, there was a period of time where when I was pretty stressed out that the poetry just kind of came to me when I was in the alpha state of sleep, and I taught myself how to write when I was half awake, because otherwise when I woke up all the way, the poetry would vanish. And I wrote a lot of poetry over probably a 2-year period, and then after Corey died, they just all dried up. So I guess I didn't need to do it that way anymore. But it was an interesting process because I'd never really, you know, I'd like to write, but I was never a poet before. Mm. And I included some of those in the book.
Yes, so you did. Yeah, very nice as well, I must say.
Thank you.
I've dabbled a little bit myself, only just out of personal interest, but it's nice, I think, when you get the urge to do it and something comes out that looks good. Now, I'd like to move on to one particular time in Corey's life when he was 6 years old, and he made a most wonderful announcement. He said energy comes from light, and then he went on to tell you that he would love you for infinity. Now, for a 6-year old to know that energy comes from light is pretty well something. Was that when he started to make more pronouncements like that?
He was, he would always sort of, I always say, drop bombshells on me, but it turns out that when he told me that, we were having dinner, and I call that my Kraft macaroni box night, where he sort of used a Kraft macaroni box as a demonstration for what the body is like. And he told me that he would love me forevermore, and that he went on to explain, as a 6-year-old, that your essence, he actually used the word essence, spirit, or soul, lives on forever. And so, therefore, he would love me for infinity, even after he died. And this was probably the within a couple days of when he had his little hissy fit at the psychologist's office when he wasn't feeling well, because a week later he was diagnosed with a double relapse.
Mm. Right.
So that made it much more real for me.
I guess that must have been the period in his life when he suddenly started to have the need for more and more regular chemotherapy. Would it be true to say that it gradually got or needed to be more frequent?
Well, he had a relapse, so he went back. You know, when you're on treatment, you have like a heavy induction phase where they really bombard your body, and then once they get you into remission, then they call it maintenance, where they give you less intensive treatment. Well, with every relapse, then you had to do the reinduction phase, which was very toxic. So having relapsed in two places, he relapsed in his testes and in his bone marrow, he was really put through the ringer. And a year later, he decided that he wanted to stop chemotherapy and stop treatment because he was tired of the toxicity.
Yes. I gather that maybe it was during that period of time, or started around that time, when he told you that he goes out of the body every night. Did he say that he went to Maui? I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly.
He did that actually before the relapses. He would come down in the morning and say that he was exhausted because he'd been running on the beach all night, and we'd go, "What? Where? You know, where was this?" And he'd say, "I went to Maui," and so he would actually go to bed at night and say, "I think I'll go back to Hawaii." And I said, "Well, I want to go with you." And he said, "Well, you have to find your own way there."
seems to me he was quite in control then of his out-of-the-body experiences.
Well, he actually was about 7 when he started having them. And he could go at will. So he did that for a year and a half before he died. And it was very comforting for him and for me to know that, you know, he actually already knew that he was going to go to a better place where he wasn't in pain all the time. And and he described how beautiful it is. But the interesting thing is, I don't know if you've ever heard of Lilydale, New York, but have you?
No, I haven't. No.
It's a spiritualist community in Western New York that's been there for 138 years. And the spiritualists, it's a religion of people that believe that the spirit lives on after death. And I went there last summer to do some research for a possible TV show. And while I was there, I picked up a book about the people of Lilydale. And about 75 pages into the book, there's a reference to heaven, and the author says heaven, or as the spiritualists call it, Summerland. Well, I was so stunned, because that was what the term that Corey used, and I'd never heard it before. I thought he made it up. Mm. So he somehow had, you know, knew this spiritualist term, but the description of it was the same of that he had described of what Summerland was like.
Oh, yes, that's very interesting. You speak often during the book of how Corey had these sudden changes in his food fads, but presumably that was entirely down to the effects of the chemotherapy. Would you say that was so?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had lots of issues around food because of the chemo and how his body either craved something or reacted to what they were giving him.
I gather he had a longish period when he couldn't eat anything other than fried chicken.
That's all he craved for a while until I have not made fried chicken ever since then, because I can't even stomach the idea of it, because I made so much chicken for him when he was craving it. But it got to the point where a long time ago, I bought a microwave and let him nuke his own chicken in the middle of the night, because otherwise he was waking me up three times a night.
Right. Okay, I think we ought to move on a little bit more to what Corey said about crossing the Rainbow Bridge, because it was quite something, I'm sure, when you first heard from him that he had spoke with God.
Oh, he walked in God's garden, and he described what that was like. He said that the plants there were amazing, and they were huge and beautiful and nothing like he'd ever seen here, and that the colors were not of this earth. And he described the music. He said, it's beautiful, Mommy. He said, the music is indescribable. He said it was very angelic. And when he walked in God's garden, he described God as a very tall man in a robe and with very piercing eyes.
Yeah.
And I said, well, was he scary? And he said, no, just very stern. But my sister's ex-husband had committed suicide the year before, right before Christmas. And Corey didn't see his Uncle John in Summerland in all the times that he'd been over there. And so he asked God, or the being that he perceived as God, where his uncle was. And he was told that his uncle had to go to a special place to think about what he'd done, because he destroyed a healthy body. And Corey said that was like spitting in God's face, because God gives you the gift of life, and that you shouldn't take your life, you know, especially if you had a healthy body, for nothing.
Yeah.
And it made him sort of angry at his uncle for doing that, because he didn't realize that his uncle was bipolar. But he'd gone off his meds, and that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, my thinking is, and I suppose it fits in with reincarnation, is that people come into life with a life plan. They have things to do for their spiritual development. So you wouldn't presumably plan to commit suicide. So in actual fact, you're releasing or giving away an opportunity to progress a bit further. And I suppose that is really what you have to contemplate when you shorten your life. You have to think about the possible harm to yourself and your development.
Absolutely. And I agree completely. That's a very, very good assessment. Well, John, it took about 6 months, and then John arrived on the scene, and Corey was very excited to see him there. And it's funny, though, because, you know, I said we were not Catholic, but what he described sounded like the Catholic version of purgatory, that he had to go to a special place and think about what he'd done.
Yeah.
So he came down the stairs that morning and told me to call my sister and the girls to tell them that John was in heaven, finally. Yeah. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah. I have to think to myself that unlike, I think, some many years ago, the church used to suggest that if you committed suicide, you went to hell. But I don't think that you're damned in that way at all. From what Corey said, and I tend to believe this, you're set aside maybe to give you plenty of time to think about the consequences of what you've done. There isn't really any form of punishment involved.
No. No. And, you know, all the time, I mean, Corey went out of body for a year and a half, and he never, ever mentioned the concept of hell, which I thought was interesting.
Well,
you know, because this is a little kid. I mean, he didn't have preconceived ideas about what he was experiencing.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I know he kept commenting, didn't he, making little spiritual sentences, like he said, be kind and loving and don't judge others. And I thought that was a very, very highly spiritual comment there.
Oh, yeah. Yep. You know, and he actually said tears healed the soul. I thought that was pretty special. And laugh till your spirit lights up.
yes, indeed. I believe it was around about that time that he first mentioned to you that he was going to come back as Michael.
Well, he actually had talked about this Michael child the whole time he was sick, because whenever they would do a painful procedure on him, he would cry and say, I want to be Michael. And I thought, what is he talking about? Well, he had a cousin named Michael, and I thought, well, maybe he just thought he wanted to be that cousin because he wasn't sick and being put through those kinds of treatments. But later, right before he passed away, he told me that that if I had another child and it was a boy, that he wanted me to name him Michael because it would be him.
Yeah.
And it was pretty funny. I said, well, what if it's a girl? And he said, I don't want to be a dumb old girl, so it won't be me. So when I got pregnant, it was a girl.
Time.
Pardon?
So I think that was an echo back you heard there. Yes, he definitely knew his mind, but we must tell our listeners at this stage that, in fact, in the end, he came back as his sister's child.
Yeah, that's kind of the big reveal at the end of the book. But there has been a lot of interesting things that my grandson has said that indicate that that's true. Because he didn't,
well,
you know, my grandson didn't know anything.
Evidently, you said that when he came back, he knew he had been Corey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He talked about it until he was about almost 9 years old. Last summer, right before last fall before the book came out, I asked him if he remembered the stuff that he told us about Uncle Corey, and he said, no, not very much. He said, but I know who I am, and that's that. And then he just kind of walked away.
Yeah. It's an almost unbelievable sequence of events, but you've obviously come to accept it, and I can tell that it doesn't sort of phase you out at all. You just sort of go along with it and deal with it.
Right. But, you know, you get to a point where, especially with a child like that, you just sort of roll with it. But he told my husband once that he'd been a girl in another lifetime, and my husband is...
Right.
A psychologist, and not, you know, he was sort of brought up in a very straight-laced Presbyterian household.
Yeah.
So he was kind of freaked out by it. But, you know, they were just sitting at the dining room table when Corey was about three, and he said that. And Steve said, really, how was it to be a girl? And he goes, oh, it was okay. And then he just changed the subject, you know. But he has said stuff to my daughter, his mom, and to my other daughter, and, you know, to people around him, and it's just funny because it was so matter of fact, and we all just kind of looked at him and smiled and said, oh, really? And then we'd ask him questions or just let him talk. But he is his namesake, so that's interesting.
Talking of reincarnation, it was interesting, again, he made a point which I personally totally agree with. He told you that you choose the age, that is after death, when you want to appear again.
Mm-hmm. You mean to when you appear to people, it's the age that you want to remember?
Well, I'm interpreting that as meaning appear again, meaning rebirth.
Oh, no. I think what I meant was when people have had seen him after he died, they all describe him as when he was about age 7. And because he's appeared to a lot of people, not just me. And so when they tell me, I say, well, what did he look like? And they say, you know, when he was about 7. So he said that if you conjure up a body and visit somebody, that you can be any age you want to, and that he would choose to be 7. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get it now. Yes, yes, indeed. I also agree with that, yes. Once you're over the other side, you can present yourself to people as you wish. And often, I guess, the idea is you do it in a way that they would immediately recognize you, sort of your familiar self, if you like.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yes. Now, Corey arranged his own funeral. I don't suppose we want to go into that too much, but that in itself was a rather extraordinary thing, wasn't it? He was very, you could say, fussy about how it was done, and he wanted you to do it exactly as he said.
Yes, he was in control, and he chose the music and who he wanted to speak and what he wanted people to wear, and you know, he didn't want it to be a sad occasion. He wanted people to celebrate his life. So we had hundreds of balloons. This is before it was against the law to release helium balloons. But he was very much in control. He chose his own casket. He chose the site at the cemetery where he wanted to be buried. So, yeah.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, if it wasn't you telling the story and you're his mother, people might tend to think that's a bit far-fetched, but it clearly isn't. Now, am I correct in thinking sometime after Corey passed on, he came back to you and sat on your bed?
Oh, he came back because he wanted me to take the money from his savings account and go see a friend of mine who is a diamond wholesaler.
Oh, yeah.
And he told me that when I saw whatever it was that he wanted me to get, that I would know because it would remind me of him and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And Elizabeth's logo was the hand releasing the butterfly. So when I actually went through all these hoops and found myself in this jewelry store, there was this beautiful butterfly necklace. And all of a sudden I heard his voice say to me, "See, I told you you'd think of Elizabeth and me." Well, then after I took it home, I was sitting on my bed fretting about it because I'd been off work for 6 weeks while he was dying and I didn't get paid. And I had to borrow money from my parents to pay my bills. And so I was sitting there looking at the necklace, sort of chastising myself about spending money that I didn't have. And I felt this elbow to my arm and I looked over and he was sitting next to me and he said, "Just put the damn thing on. It wasn't your money to begin with." So I put it on and I turned to show it to him and he was gone. And then I heard his voice as he was fading away saying, "Happy Mother's Day, Mommy," because he died on Mother's Day.
Isn't that wonderful? I mean, that's a really lovely story, I must say. Now, a little bit later, what happened when I think you found some old drawings of Corey's, which was rather important?
He had drawings and little notes all over the house. He put one in a travel case that I had. He put some underneath a Jimi Hendrix poster that was in his room, and they were for different people, not just me. But, he'd left little love notes with drawings of Garfield all over the place.
Oh,
he was very much into planning.
Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful to think that he had the forethought to want to give all his family and possibly friends little notes, but he did it in a way to make them as little surprises when you found them.
Mm-hmm. He did. That's he hid them under his bed, in his drawers, you know, they were everywhere, in books.
Yes. Of course, he often, I believe, told you during his life with you, that he would always be with you. And I suppose in as much as he said that you were together before and he came back into your family via his sister, that really turned out to be true, didn't it? I mean, he sort of stayed in the family.
He did. And the interesting thing, too, is when I went to Lilydale, he came through. And when I was talking to one of the mediums, and I said, you know, I don't understand how you can be in two places at once. And that was my only question that I had in going there, besides, you know, thinking about doing a series. And he came through and he told me that he wanted to answer my question, and that if I thought about when you spray a aerosol or a mist, how the particles go off in different directions, but they're all still part of the same beginning. And he said, that's how I can be here talking to you and then also be in Hawaii with him.
Yeah. Yes, I've often read that we have a number of aspects of ourselves, so that to me would be quite an acceptable explanation for it.
Mm-hmm.
What is your position today now where Corey is concerned? I mean, does he still talk through your sister and talk about the past, or has he moved on a bit?
My grandson?
Yeah.
He actually has moved on a little bit, but when my son came through to me at Lilydale, he told me that we should call my grandson by his middle name so that he could have his own identity. And it's funny thing is I had always done that since he was a baby. And he said, yeah, tell Bri to call me, to call him Keawe, so he has his own identity. So he talked, when he talked to me when I was in Lilydale, he talked about my grandson like he was a separate person.
I mean, it must be rather strange for your sister to have had Corey come back through her. Did she?
Oh, my daughter.
Did she accept that very easily?
She did, actually, because she's had a lot of after-death experiences with him as well. And then she and Corey's dad, Keawe's dad, had agreed to call him Corey to honor her brother. But then neither one of them could use that name because it sort of freaked everybody out because he looked just like him when he was a baby. He doesn't so much now. He looks like his own self. But he was a dead ringer for him when he was the first year. People would see him and they would burst into tears. Because he looks so much like my son.
Yeah. Well, Shirley, we've had a little stoppage, and I've ran on slightly longer than normal. But believe it or not, we're coming near the end of the program, so I think you ought to take this time, a couple of minutes, just to tell our listeners what your website address is and where they can buy your book.
Okay, thank you. Well, my website is overtherainbowbridge.info, and you can buy it through there, or Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and also it's an ebook on Smashwords.com. So any of those would be great.
Right, that's lovely. That information will be confirmed in the archive write-up, so if anyone's missed it, they can check that out on BBS. Thank you very much for coming onto the program. It's been a terrifically interesting time talking with you, and I doubt whether there are many people, if any, that can relate an experience like you have just spoken about. But it's wonderful, and I think you're obviously a very wonderful mother as well, the way you handled it. So thank you very much for coming onto the program.
Thank you, Michael, and any time. I would be happy to chat with you again. Take care.
Let me know when you've written your next book.
Okay, sounds good.
Or when it's coming out.
Right,
friend. That was a terrific interview. Just want to quickly mention that I have next week Rahazia Poe, who's written a book, To Believe or Not to Believe, about the social and neurological consequences of belief systems. And what he wants to do in the book is take people right into the consequences of religious and national belief systems. And he goes back and talks about beliefs going right back to the Iron Age and things like that. He talks about archaeological finds that affected people's beliefs. So it's again, I think that will be a very unusual interview. So thank you for being with me today, and I trust you can be with me next week. God bless you all. Thank you.